welcome to the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier on IRIS for November 10th, Tuesday. My name is Erin. Our first article from the front page, mask mandate extended. Waterloo Council's okays another 12 weeks, 7-0. Cindy Zizon, Waterloo. For the first time since the mask mandate's inception in August, all 7 Waterloo City Council members Monday voted to approve an extension of the guidelines. The 7-0 vote for a 12-week extension came amid Black Hawk County's highest COVID-19 positivity rate of the pandemic. The county has a 24.9% 14-day positivity rate and 7,750 total positive cases from PCR lab testing, according to local data. The positivity rate is calculated by dividing the number of positive tests by the total number of people tested. Black Hawk County reported 220 new cases Monday, with one additional death for a total of 108. The state reported 4,212 new cases Monday. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported another record in hospitalization with 1,034. In the 24 hours before 10 a.m. Monday, 152 patients were admitted to the hospital, 184 were in the ICU, and 82 on ventilators. The state reported 3 additional deaths for a total of 1,845. Quote, "We are at a dangerous place with COVID," end quote, said Council Member Jonathan Greider, who introduced the resolution for the mandate. Quote, "We have to do better, and this face mask mandate is part of that," end quote. The guidelines require people to wear masks inside public buildings, such as grocery stores and city facilities. The mandate also requires people to wear masks when outside if 6 feet of distance is not possible and when using transportation services. People with certain health conditions, children under 2, and public safety employees are exempt. Other exemptions exist for people who are alone, with household members exercising, eating, or drinking. The council's decision followed Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart's announcement Monday that he tested positive for COVID-19. He said he is, quote, "on the other side of recovery," end quote. Council Member Margaret Klein, who voted against the initial mandate and its first extension, decided to support the most recent extension at Monday's meeting. She said she feels people's worry about COVID-19 is increasing, but she wonders whether implementing a mandate will cause some people to rebel against it. Quote, "I don't think it does anything," Klein said. "I want the people of Waterloo to be as hopeful as they can be, and if this little thing makes them feel that way, then I will support it," end quote. Council Member Dave Boson, who voted against the first extension, still cited lack of enforcement. He said it remains the role of the city council to encourage people to wear masks, even if it is not allowed by everyone. He pushed back against people who say masks do not always work. Quote, "I'll tell you that parachutes don't always work either, but I want to have one if I jump out of a plane," end quote, Boson said. Boson brought up the idea of extending the mandate for 12 weeks rather than 6. All council members supported the extension aside from Klein, who said the mandate should be in place for as short of a time as necessary. Our next front page article, Waterloo Mayor Hit by COVID. Quentin Hart says he has mild symptoms by Cindy Zizon, Waterloo. Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart is self-isolating at home with COVID-19, he announced Monday via Zoom at the city council meeting. Hart did not share when he was diagnosed, but he said he began isolating several days before Monday. He is unsure how he contracted the virus. His announcement came as Black Hawk County saw a 24.9% 14-day positivity rate. The total number of positive cases from PCR lab testing is 7,750, and 108 people have died from the virus, county data shows. Hart said he did not have a fever or receive any services from healthcare providers. His symptoms include feeling tired and sore, he said. Quote, "I'm on the other side of recovery," Hart told the city council. "I do feel good, but keep your hearts and minds toward my family and other families and people that are impacted," end quote. Hart said he transported a sick family member to the emergency room last week who got tested for COVID-19. He said it took more than 3 hours for his relative to see a doctor at the hospital. Hart watched as long lines of people waited inside and outside the facility. He thanked healthcare workers for their response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The mayor said he had, quote, "very minimal interaction," end quote, over the past week with city officials and residents. He said he contacted people directly with whom he interacted in person. Most of his meetings were held on Zoom, he said. Quote, "Fortunately, in City Hall, I don't necessarily even visit with people. people, end quote, Hart said. He continues working remotely, noting it became the, quote, way of life, end quote, since the pandemic began spreading in the United States. Quote, we pretty much got used to this new normal starting in March when we had to shift the way we do business, end quote, Hart said. Hart said is meeting with staff members virtually to monitor the city's COVID-19 response. He said he will communicate with Waterloo schools to see what can be done to keep students safe. Quote, the numbers we are starting to see right now are absolutely staggering, end quote, he said. Over the summer, he said it was uncommon for people to know someone who died from COVID-19. Quote, it's hard for us to say that nowadays, end quote, Hart said. Hart's disclosure of his COVID-19 status came at the same meeting where council members unanimously extended the city's mask mandate. Hart asked the council members to attend the meeting via Zoom. Only City Clerk Kelly Fletchy and some members of the public were in the City Hall chambers. Quote, it really felt good to have the entire City Council tell the community that we are concerned about the numbers, end quote, Hart said. Hart said he is grateful Cedar Falls passed its own mask mandate and encouraged the Blackhawk County Board of Supervisors to pass its own guidelines. The county supervisors did not approve a mask mandate resolution in September. Our next front page article, Biden makes virus a priority as vaccine progress reported by Will Weisart, Philip Marcello, and Amir Manhadi by the Associated Press, Wilmington, Delaware. As pharmaceutical giant Pfizer announced progress with its vaccine trial, President-elect Joe Biden signaled strongly on Monday that fighting the raging pandemic will be the immediate priority of his new administration as the nation surpassed 10 million COVID-19 cases. Biden began with a direct appeal to all Americans to wear masks, a departure from President Donald Trump, who has mocked Biden and others who make a point of always wearing protective face coverings when around others. In an official move, the president-elect formed a coronavirus advisory board dominated by scientists and doctors, while Trump has had a falling out with the medical experts on his own virus task force. Also on Monday, the Food and Drug Administration cleared an experimental antibody drug from Eli Lilly for people 12 and older with mild or moderate COVID-19, not requiring hospitalization. It's a one-time treatment given through an IV. The therapy is still undergoing additional testing to establish its safety and effectiveness. It is similar to a treatment Trump received after contracting the virus last month. The swift actions came at a critical moment in the U.S. effort to combat the coronavirus as surging caseloads, including new infections among leading figures in Trump's administration, offered a fresh reminder that the nation is still in the grip of the worst pandemic in more than a century. Quote, the challenge before us right now is still immense and growing, and so is the need for bold action to fight this pandemic, end quote, Biden said after being briefed on the virus. Quote, we are still facing a dark winter, end quote. He called on Americans to separate politics from the virus and embrace mask wearing. Quote, we could save tens of thousands of lives if everyone would just wear a mask for the next few months, not Democratic or Republican lives, American lives, Biden said. Please, I implore you, wear a mask, end quote. Over the past 2 weeks, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases has risen nearly 65%. The 7-day rolling average for daily new cases in the U.S. went from 66,294 on October 25th to 108,736.7 on a Sunday. In the past week, one of every 433 Americans was diagnosed with COVID-19, and hospitals in several states are running out of space and staff. Biden noted the pandemic's disproportionate toll on people of color as he called on Americans to separate politics from the virus and embrace mask wearing. Quote, focusing on these communities is one of our priorities, not an afterthought, end quote, Biden said. Pfizer said Monday that its COVID-19 vaccine may be a remarkable 90% effective based on early and incomplete test results. The drug maker said it was on track to file an emergency use request with regulators later this month. The president, who has yet to publicly acknowledge Biden's victory, seized on Pfizer's announcement and the positive reaction in financial markets. Quote, and all capitals, stock market up big, vaccine coming soon, report 90% effective, such great news, end quote, he tweeted. Vice President Mike Pence held a meeting meeting of the White House Coronavirus Task Force on Monday, he tweeted that Pfizer's reported progress, quote, was huge news, end quote, and suggested it was the result of a, quote, public-private partnership forged, end quote, by Trump. In fact, Pfizer has funded all its own research. It has a contract to sell doses to the U.S. government if a vaccine is approved, but has insisted on handling its own shipping. The White House task force, which includes the federal government's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has been diminished in recent months as Trump grew impatient with efforts to slow the virus that were having a deleterious impact on the economy. A top Trump administration health official delivered much the same message as Biden, although the timing was coincidental and the occasion apolitical. Brett Greyer, Assistant Secretary for Health Administration, said that Americans must, quote, double down, end quote, on the, quote, three W's, end quote, watching their distance from others, wearing masks when that's not possible, and washing their hands frequently. He also said states and local communities must ramp up testing. The advisory board that Biden announced on Monday includes doctors and scientists who have served in previous administrations, many of them experts in public health, vaccines, and infectious disease. It will be led by former Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy, former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner David Kessler, and Yale University Public Health Care expert Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith. Rick Bright, a vaccine expert and former head of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Developmental Authority, is also on the board. He had filed a whistleblower complaint alleging he was reassigned to a lesser job because he resisted political pressure to allow widespread use of hydroxychloroquine, a malaria drug pushed by Trump as a COVID-19 treatment. Other members include Dr. Luciana Borio, who had senior leadership positions at the FDA and National Security Council during the Obama and Trump administrations, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who served as a special advisor for the health policy in the Obama administration, Dr. Atul Gawande, a senior advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration and medical writer, and Michael Osterholm, an epidemiologist who served as an advisor to Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson during the George W. Bush administration. Public health officials warn that U.S. could be entering the worst stretch yet for COVID-19 as winter sets in and the holiday season approaches, increasing the risk of rapid transmission as Americans travel, shop, and celebrate with loved ones. The last front page article, Janeville seeks waiver as virus concerns close school. More than 60 pupils were absent Monday, by Andrew Wind, Janesville. Janesville Consolidated School officials are seeking to move classes temporarily online following a critical mass of COVID-19 related absences. Students were sent home from school early Monday, and the district announced it will not reopen until after Wednesday. More than 60 students were absent when the day started or were excused from class prior to early dismissal. Absences at the school have been growing for the past 2 weeks. Superintendent B.J. Meany told the Board of Education Monday night the numbers have exceeded 60, even though a few people were just coming out of a 14-day quarantine. Quote, the numbers going the wrong direction, end quote, he noted. He submitted a waiver request to the state in the morning asking to move all students online for 2 weeks. A response is expected from the Iowa Department of Education 24 to 48 hours after the request was received. Quote, we've tried to front load and prepare parents for this day, end quote, Meany said during an interview earlier in the day. Quote, it just got to that point that it felt not safe to have 470 kids together in one location, even with masks and all other mitigation strategies, end quote. An initial count of absences Monday morning showed 59 of them were for coronavirus symptoms, possibly exposure to COVID-19 or quarantining, a 12.8% absence rate. According to state guidelines, an absence rate above 10% can trigger a move to online learning for 2 weeks if the count County a school district is in has a test positivity rate above 15%. The 14-day positivity rate is currently 27.5% for Bremer County and 24.9% for Blackhawk County. Janesville's attendance boundaries include portions of both counties. Janesville School has had 9 positive case COVID-19 tests among staff and students this fall, and Meany said, quote, about half of those are active cases, end quote. Roughly 20 people were absent because they had tested positive or had one or two major COVID-19 symptoms. The other approximately 40 people were absent because they had been directly exposed to someone who were positive. Quote, the time has come, end quote, said Meany of closing the school in response to the virus. Quote, it's here and it's sort of taken over our building, end quote. He showed board members the proposal for elementary school students' time online with their teachers if the district moves to virtual learning. Teachers would record sessions with their students from school. The plan includes progressively more time by grade level, starting at up to 30 minutes total per day for preschool and kindergarten students and rising to 120 minutes for fourth and fifth graders. Time online would be evenly divided between 3 content areas. The time in class would further grow for middle and high school students. Quote, we have asked the teachers to review the proposal tonight for feedback tomorrow, end quote. Meany told the board, officials are working to get hotspot devices for families who don't have internet access. Regarding non-teaching staff, he proposed keeping them on payroll during any shutdown of the school building. Quote, we paid them in March, April, and May, and I think it's in our best interest to pay them however long this lasts, end quote, Meany said. A district administrators meeting will be held a Tuesday morning, during which he said there will be a, quote, more detailed discussion of what this would look like if we do have to go to 14 days, end quote, of online learning. Currently, the district has 25 students fully learning online after their parents chose to keep them at home this fall. Moving to the Cedar Valley section, City Telecom study a business secret. Waterloo says release of report would hurt its ability to compete by Sydney Saison Waterloo. City officials were publicly releasing Waterloo's broadband study would hurt the city's ability to compete with Mediacom, a major internet provider in the area. The concern was outlined in a response to an Iowa Public Information Board complaint filed by the Courier. Attorney Chris Wedland, who works for the city's legal department, said disclosing marketing and pricing strategies for a city-owned utility, quote, would harm the competitive position of the municipal telecommunications utility before it could even get off the ground, end quote. Quote, one can reasonably expect that if such information is put in the public domain, then the information would put the nascent utility at a competitive disadvantage, end quote, Wedland wrote. The complaint to the IPIB was made after the city declined to release a copy of the broadband study, citing parts of Iowa code that protect, quote, draft, end quote, materials. The Telecommunications Utility Board of Trustees then met privately to review the study again, stating they were protected by Iowa code that allows executive sessions to look over confidential documents. The city also referenced part of the code that protects utility records that include private customer information. Wendland noted Mediacom is not under legal obligation to release its pricing and cost data or marketing strategies. Quote, as a non-governmental entity, Mediacom is a profit-seeking business that is permitted to develop its marketing and pricing strategies and related property information behind closed doors, end quote, Wedland wrote. The city referred to the study as material that is, quote, preliminary only and not intended as a basis for official action, end quote. The city commissioned the study about a year ago to be completed by Magellan Advisors, a consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. In 2009, city council members unanimously voted to reallocate about $110,000 in unspent general obligation bonds to cover the cost of the study. Quote, the utility will not have a fair chance to succeed if it must show its hand to a private competitor before the utility even has an opportunity to decide the essential steps to begin organizing an operational plan, end quote, Wedland wrote. The city argued its decision to keep the study private is allowed under Iowa law. The IP IB will review the open records and open meeting law complaint as early as November 19th to decide whether it will take further action regarding Waterloo's decisions about the broadband study. Randy Evans, executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, previously told the Courier that Waterloo residents, quote, are entitled to know what the consultant has said about the viability of such a broadband network, end quote. Evans said the study should not be considered a draft since it is in the hands of officials who can recommend approval of the broadband utility. He said the city's claims of protecting private customer information would not apply to potential utilities, only existing ones. Iowa public records law and attorney general guidance does not allow entire documents to be kept confidential because there is some confidential material in the documents, Evans says. Our next article, An Old Hand with Llamas. Bill Rector, 90, has raised llamas for more than half a century by Melody Parker, Denver. Bill Rector, 90, is likely one of the oldest, if not the oldest, llama breeder in the nation. His home office and a nearby spare room are stuffed to overflowing with trophies, ribbons, and grand champion rosettes, along with photographs of winning llamas in the show ring. He has been breeding and showing llamas for more than half a century. Each day, he energetically tends to his herd that once numbered about 50 or more, but these days it's far fewer. His grandson, Matthew, and granddaughter, Amanda, have picked up where he left off raising, showing, and selling llamas. Quote, they are easy to care for, very nice, and docile animals, Rector said. Amanda comes out early in the morning and does chores for me. I've been lucky because 5 of the 8 grandchildren have been interested in showing the llamas, end quote. He has both herd series and breeding females. Rector traces his interest in raising exotic animals to his childhood pet, Tony the Pony. He spotted the pony while at a livestock sale barn with his father. Quote, my dad said, that's just what you need, and I thought so too. The man selling the pony asked me how much money I had, and I had $15. He said, that's exactly what I want for it, and the pony was mine, end quote, he recalled with a smile. Rector has spent most of his life farming and more than half of his life raising exotic animals. After he returned from serving in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War, he met and married his sweetheart, Dina, and they reared 4 children. At one time, he owned about 17 ponies and horses, as well as white-tailed deer and exotic birds, including peacocks, ostriches, emus, and swans. Quote, I wondered if maybe I should get a bison, but Dina said no. No buffalo. I like to say I buffaloed her because I ended up buying a pair of llamas, end quote, Rector said, smiling. He traded his white-tailed deer and $300 for his first llama pair in 1968. Rector loved their gentle, curious personalities and their calm demeanor in the show ring. Quote, we always had school children coming out with their classes to tour the farm and see the llamas and other animals. Amanda still leads llama hikes on the farm, end quote, he said. Rector still bombs around his farm with a 4-wheeler, runs a combine, and sells NK seeds, and he hasn't lost interest in his llamas. Quote, I still enjoy them. They always come up to greet me. They crowd up to the fence, and it's so good to see, end quote. Our next article, results affirmed at local precinct. CF site was randomly audited by the state by Sydney Sison, Cedar Falls. A Blackhawk County polling place in Cedar Falls was chosen randomly by the Iowa Secretary of State to complete a post-election audit, according to a news release. The audit Friday required poll workers to hand count results on the ballot's top race, comparing those findings to election night results from the voting machines. The hand counted matched the machine count at Candio Church in Cedar Falls, which sits in the city's 2nd Ward, 3rd Precinct. The location received 812 votes cast, the release said. The top race was that hand counted was for U.S. President. The polling location recorded 565 votes for President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, 231 votes for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, 9 votes for Joe Jorgensen and Jeremy Cohen, and 1 vote for Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker, and 1 vote for Kanye West and Michelle Tidball. There were 4 write-ins and 1 undervote, meaning someone did not cast a vote for the U.S. presidential race. The audit was handled by 3 precinct workers under the supervision of Karen Showalter, County Elections Director. County Auditor Grant Beter said the audit showed the reliability of Iowa's election system. Quote, this is one of numerous safeguards to the system, but it is especially significant because it is proof that after the fact, end quote, Beter said in a news release. Quote, it shows that the system worked the way it was supposed to, end quote. Precincts in all 99 Iowa counties were required to complete audits the day after the November 3rd election. Our Secretary of State, Paul Pate, chose precincts at random. Election numbers are not finalized until after counties conduct post-election canvasses and numbers are certified statewide at the end of November. County election boards must complete the official canvas of votes by the end of Tuesday. Campaigns then have 3 days after the canvas to request a recount. And our next article, UNI has success slowing COVID spread, cases rising but rates trailing state. Andrew Wind, Cedar Falls, the University of Northern Iowa's COVID-19 response team says efforts to stop the spread of the virus on campus have been effective. That can be seen through the campus infection rate, a new piece of data UNI has added to its online dashboard tracking the disease impact. The dashboard shows the rate in a graph comparing UNI to positive tests in Black Hawk County and the state. Quote, what we are seeing is that our campus community has an infection rate half of the county. This reinforces that the controls we have put in place are working, end quote, according to a recent update from the response team. For the most recent week ending November 1, UNI's infection rate was at 0.52%. Black Hawk County was at 1.04%. And the state of Iowa was at 0.78%. The measure focuses on the occurrence of new coronavirus cases within a certain population over the previous 2 weeks. The rolling 14-day total of positive tests is divided by the population, all UNI students and employees in this instance. Hawkeye Community College in Waterloo and Wartburg College in Waverly use an infection rate measure in their online dashboards. For UNI, this adds to the weekly reporting it does on the positivity rate. That is the percentage of positive COVID-19 cases as at its student health center among those who were given the test. The positivity rate has been growing in recent weeks, and the actual number of COVID-19 cases for the past week has exceeded all previous individual weeks totals this fall. The Student Health Center reported 96 positive tests November 2nd through the 8th. A total of 255 tests were administered to students and employees during that time for a positivity rate of 37.65%. That is a decline of less than 1% from what UNI reported for the partial week on Friday. The number of tests done by the center since August 17th is 1,682, 349 of which were positive. Of those, 155 were added in the last 3 weeks when the positivity rate started to grow. Quote, despite the rise in cases, our data indicates COVID-19 is not being spread on our campus, end quote, said the responses team's update. Rather, quote, individuals are primarily coming into contact with the virus when in close proximity with affected friends or family members or when attending social gatherings, end quote. The lack of campus spread has been helped by an early and compressed semester that will end at Thanksgiving and mitigation efforts in classrooms, according to the team. The Department of Residence reported Monday that 35 students living on campus were in quarantine because they might have been exposed to COVID-19. Less than six students with confirmed cases were in isolation. For the same week, there were 62 self-reported new cases of COVID-19, some of which may duplicate the health center numbers. 16 of the self-reported cases were employees. The others were students. There have been a total of 257 self-reported cases since September 1, 32 of them employees. Wartburg College reported 20 positive or inconclusive cases among students and employees as of Sunday through its online dashboard. The college reports the total number of positive cases most days of the week. The number of positive cases last week started out at 9 students on November 2nd and rose through the week. As of Sunday, 20 people were in isolation and 89 were in quarantine. The campus infection rate was 0.98%. That is based on the number of people on campus testing positive out of all Wartburg students and employees. Moving to obituaries, Roger L. Stalker, Marshalltown. Roger L. Stalker, 77, of Marshalltown, passed away peacefully Thursday, November 5th, 2020, under the care of the Iowa River Hospice. A celebration of life will be held Wednesday evening, November 11th, from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. at the Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Shriners Children's Hospital in Roger's memory. For further information or to send Roger's family a condolence, please visit www.mitchellfh.com or call 641-844-1234. Roger Lawrence Stalker was born on December 29, 1942, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Lawrence and Dorothy Collins Stalker. He grew up in Waterloo and LaPorte City before enlisting in the United States Navy in 1961. He faithfully served our country and was honorably discharged in 1963. After his service, he resided in the rural Gladbeck, Rhinebeck, Lincoln area, where he had been employed over the years at Hoag and Ames Well Drilling, operated his own backhoe and dirt moving business, Lynx Hybrid Seed and Gethem Construction Incorporated, and then chose retirement. Roger was a lifetime member of the Lincoln and Vets Post 10. He moved to Marshalltown in 1992. In addition to being a lifelong Indian motorcycle enthusiast and a Harley-Davidson KR and a half mile flat track racer, Roger enjoyed restoring Indian motorcycles, Harley-Davidsons, and boats. Roger was a member of the Marshalltown Area Restorers Region, and in his pastime, he enjoyed boating and fishing. Left to cherish his memory are his children, Greg's spouse Annie Stalker and Carrie Staker, his grandchildren, Kaylee Staker and Dalton Weldborer, his significant companion of 29 years, Helga Ruba, and her children, Carmen spouse Robert Twani and Cord Ruba, his sister Carol Woodward, and many other grandchildren, nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends. In eternal life, Roger has been reunited with his parents and his granddaughter Alexis Ann Wood. Joanne M. Beasley, Waterloo. Joanne M. Beasley, 72, of Waterloo, died Thursday, November 5th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. She was born September 14th, 1948, in Waterloo, daughter of Leonard and Evelyn Becker. She married Richard Beasley in 1984 in Nashua. Survivors include her husband, two aunts, Goldie spouse Glide Johnson, and Jermaine Lippert, both of Waterloo, and many cousins. Preceded in death by her sister Mary Lou Becker, six uncles Henry, Edwin, Arnold, Jerry, Hubert, and Wilfred Becker, and three aunts Ruby Shock, Cleone Sternberg, and Henrietta Becker. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 10th at Haggerty Weychoff Gerup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway with burial in Garden of Memories Cemetery. Visitation will be for 1 hour before services. Masks and social distancing are required. Condolences may be left with www.haggertyweychoffgerup.com. Ardith L. Hines, Waterloo. Ardith Lucille Hines, 83, entered into God's greatest eternal light at 12:10 a.m. Monday, November 9th, 2020. She was born on March 10th, 1937, in Chicago, Illinois, to Robert C. and Helen Shoupe French. She was baptized into the Lutheran Church on March 29th, 1953, in OCH, Iowa. She was and still remains the beloved wife of Wayne L. Hines, who she married on March 7th, 1954. They shared 66 years on this earth together and had four children: Suzanne Cobain of Cedar Falls, Don Cullen of Denver, John spouse Jill Hines of Vermilion, South Dakota, and Ray fiance Lisa Jameson Hines of Cedar Falls. They were blessed in life with 11 grandchildren and 27 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her paternal grandparents, Lulu and Merrill Shoup, who raised her, and a great-granddaughter, Addison Hines. Visitation will be held Thursday, November 12th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Richardson Funeral Service, where there will be a special prayer service for a time to share memories beginning at 6:30 p.m. Funeral services will be conducted at 10 a.m. Friday, November 13th at R. Redemir Lutheran Church, 904 Bluff Street, Cedar Falls, with visitation from 9:30 to 10 a.m. at the church. Burial in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Waterloo. Attendees will need to bring and wear a face mask. Memorials may be directed to the family. Condolences may be left at www. www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Marilyn M. Tix, Waterloo. Marilyn M. Tix, 75, of Waterloo, Iowa, passed away Friday, November 6, 2020, at Manor Care. There will be no services at this time. Memorials may be directed to the family, and online condolences may be left at www.parrotandwood.com. Parrot and Wood Chapel of Memories is assisting the family. 319-232-3235. Billy L. Fink. Billy L. Fink passed away on October 18, 2020 at Sheraton Nursing and Rehab in Sheraton, Iowa. No services are planned at this time. Ruth E. Carnes, Waterloo. Ruth E. Carnes, 79, of Waterloo, died Friday, November 6th at the Western Home Communities Martin Center. She was born November 10th, 1941 in Waterloo, daughters of Williams and Phillips Saunders Crow. She married James G. Carnes on July 2nd, 1960 in Waterloo. He died October 27th, 2012. Ruth was employed with Family Management, Iowa Public Employees Credit Union, and American Color Imagining until retirement. Survivors include three sons, Mike's spouse Lee Ann Carnes of St. Peters, Missouri, Brian's spouse Becky Carnes, and Scott's spouse Connie Pierce Carnes, both of Waterloo, seven grandchildren and six great-grandchildren, and two sisters, Hazel's spouse Jerry Carnes of Waterloo and Margaret Bettis of Cedar Falls, preceded in death by two brothers, Wayne and Bill Crow, and two sisters, Ella Mae Timian and Norma Gerhold. Services will be 11 a.m. Friday, November 13th at Haggerty Weishoff Garup Funeral Services on South Street with burial in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Visitation will be from 9:30 to service time on Friday. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association. Condolences may be left with www.haggertyweishoffgarup.com. Timothy Tim Shell. Timothy Tim Shell was born July 11, 1954 in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of William and Patricia Hapakoti Shell. He graduated from Waterloo West High School in 1972. Tim married Shirley Snyder August 18, 1973 at the Black Hawk Roller Dome on roller skates. He enjoyed hockey, stock car races, traveling, and riding on the trails. Jim always posted a joke on the day of Facebook. He was not only a member, but the president of the Tim Shell Club. He was a jack of all trades and a go-to person for advice. Tim was very well connected with his community at Young Arena. In Shell's Corner, the leaning pole was his spot to watch hockey. Tim also was a volunteer fireman with Evansdale from 1986 to 1994. Tim passed away on Friday, November 6th, 2020, at the age of 66. He was preceded in death by his parents and a daughter, Ruth Ann. Tim was survived by his wife, Shirley of Waterloo, a son, Jonathan, spouse Danielle Shell of Sumner, two daughters, Shannon Carpenter of Mason City, and Billy Joe, spouse Jason Oldokwaski of Waterloo, 10 grandchildren, a great-grandchild, and one on the way, and three brothers, Steve Shell of Cedar Falls, Tom, spouse Joanne Shell of Stark, Florida, and Mike, spouse Tammy Shell of Cedar Falls, four sisters, Cindy, spouse Jim Nesson of Wadena, Sue, spouse Rick Wells of Waterloo, Stacy Jackson of Waterloo, and Jackie, spouse Brian Underwood of Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to the family. Celebration of life will be held at Parrot and Wood Chapel of Memories, 965 Home Plaza, on Wednesday, November 11th, 2020, from 3 to 7 p.m. Parrot and Wood Chapel of Memories is in charge of arrangements. 319-232-3235. Condolences may be left at www.parrotandwood.com. Richard W. Sides. Richard W. Dick Sides, 73, of LaPorte City, died at home November 7th after a 14-year battle with lymphoma leukemia. He was born August 3rd, 1947, son of Warren Artman Jr. and Ruby Dixon Sides. Dick graduated from LaPorte City High School in 1965 and married Sally Fick Sides on October 17th, 1970 at St. James Lutheran Church, Allison. He worked for the LaPorte City Telephone Company for 44 years, retiring December 31st, 2009. He was a member of American Lutheran Church, LaPorte City, Trowel Lodge No. 216, and Ascalon Lodge Number 393, LaPorte City Planning and Zoning, LaPorte City Golf Course, and LaPorte City Fire Department. Dick enjoyed golfing, hunting, and fishing in Chetek, Wisconsin with his family. Dick is survived by his wife, Sally, sons, Scott, spouse Lee Sides, and Jeff, spouse Janelle Sides, daughter Jana, spouse Mike Timmer, all of LaPorte City, grandchildren Adam, spouse Ashley Pennell, Matt, spouse Jamie Pennell, Kimberly, spouse Jacob Schmidt Sides, Natalie, spouse Noah Pittman Sides, Nelson Sides, Nora Sides, Naomi Sides, Ashley Heller, Austin, spouse Maddie Winter Timmer, Andrew Timmer, Allison Timmer, 7 great-grandchildren, sister Helen, spouse Patrick Merchant of Bedford, Indiana. He is preceded by his parents. Family gathering with Masonic's service 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 10th. Funeral services will be Wednesday, November 11th at American Lutheran Church, LaPorte City, with visitation for an hour before the service. Interment will in Westview Cemetery. Memorials to LaPorte City Fire Department or American Lutheran Church, LaPorte City. Masks are required for the services. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Bonnie L. Wilberding. Bonnie Lane Bunny Wilberding was born November 3, 1933, to Lucy and George Crowley in Mitchell County, Iowa. She lived in Iowa most of her life and spent her later years in Arizona. She died due to COVID-19 on November 4, 2020. Bonnie is preceded in death by sons Robert Deeds and Craig Deeds, sister Marvel Schmidt, brother Keith Crowley, and parents Lucy and George Crowley. Her fierce spirit, witty conversation, and purposeful lessons will be cherished and remembered by son Dennis spouse Kathy Deeds of Arizona, son Bruce Deeds of Iowa, daughter Cindy spouse Brian Pinsinka of Missouri, sister Marvorette Detmer of Iowa, brother Malvern Crawley of Arizona, grandchildren Kevin spouse Sarah Deeds of Iowa, Lisa spouse Jeff Randall of Missouri, Justin Deeds of Arizona, Cameron Deeds of Arizona, Clint Pinsinka of Missouri, Amity Pinsinka of Indiana, Brad spouse Lisa Phelps of Arizona, and 6 great-grandchildren. Bonnie was a senseless death and end result of politicians who value their popularity, prestige, and next term by choosing not to acknowledge the severity of the crisis and not providing clear direction or leadership on handling the COVID-19 pandemic. Along with those politicians are the people who refuse to wear a mask, won't social distance, or take any efforts to mitigate the transmission of this horrific disease. Many thanks to Apache Junction Care Center and the staff for relentless care and attention to their patients. Moving to sports, state football playoffs, spreading crowds to control the spread. But social distancing is key component for UNI Dome plan by Nick Petros, Cedar Falls. As Iowa cases of COVID-19 hit record levels and Cedar Valley hospitals reach capacity, attendance is unlikely to be restricted inside the UNI Dome for this weekend's Iowa high school football playoffs. The University of Northern Iowa, following a recommendation from Blackhawk County public health officials, has decided attendance will be reserved seating with pods of tickets from 1 to 6 available for purchase. The rows directly in front and behind a pod of spectators will remain open. Anywhere from 2 to 6 empty seats are to stay open on each side of a group. Justin Schmemmel, UNI Deputy Athletic Director for Internal Operations, says the required open seats are in the process of being marked off. The estimate's capacity could reach near 7,000 with the plan currently in place. Iowa High School Athletic Association Director Tom Keating says attendance for popular games in the state's largest classes has reached upward of 6,000 in previous years. If 7,000 fans were to attend a game, that would mark 43% of the UNI's dome, 16,324 seat capacity. A total of 13,535 fans, 22% of Jack Trice Stadium capacity, attended Saturday night's Iowa State game against Baylor. Attendance for the Iowa game against Michigan State was restricted to 1,441. Asked if he's comfortable with 6,000 or more fans showing up for a game inside the UNI Dome, Schmemmel responded, quote, I'm really I'm relying on the public health officials to tell me what they're comfortable with, end quote. Ketting says his organization will defer to the local public health department and you and I to determine what's appropriate. Quote, with the distancing they're going to do, with the size of the facility, with the amount of time that we've been giving games so that we can get people out before the next group comes in and we can sanitize before they come in, I'm comfortable, end quote, Keating said. Quote, if you and I wasn't comfortable, then we wouldn't be. We're taking our lead from them. If they were to tell us tomorrow you can't have any fans, then that's what we live by, end quote. Beyond the social distance complaint seating, compliant seating, several other safety precautions will be evident within the UNI dome. All attendees are required to wear masks and keep them on unless they're eating or drinking. Signage is in place throughout the concourse urging people to social distance, and public address announcements will deliver a similar message. Four games will be held daily from Thursday through Saturday, with the potential to bring around 18,000 people into Cedar Falls each day. The state finals are scheduled to run November 19th and 20th inside the UNI Dome, typically a major boost to Cedar Falls' economy. The large number of football fans traveling into town comes amid a recent surge both statewide and locally in COVID-19 cases. A record 5,147 Iowans tested positive for the virus November 2nd. The 14-day case average has grown from 1,300 on October 26 to 2,786 entering this week. During a press conference held by Governor Kim Reynolds last week, leaders of Iowa's two largest hospital systems urged Iowans to avoid large gatherings. Black Hawk County is averaging 158 positive cases over the past 7 days, with a current 24.9% positive testing average. A month ago, the county was averaging 20 cases. Those case increases have taken a toll on local hospitals. Quote, we're at a critical point in our state's fight against COVID-19, end quote, a recent statement by Unity Point Health noted. Quote, it is going to take every one of us doing our part to get the virus under control. Please protect your family, your community, and your local healthcare workers by wearing a mask, washing your hands, staying home when you are sick, practicing social distancing, and getting your flu shot. If we work together, we can reduce the COVID positivity numbers, end quote. Nafisa Sisi Abuwani, director of the Black Hawk County Health Department, was unavailable for comment Monday regarding guidance given to UNI and the IHSAA for this weekend's playoff games. Cedar Falls Mayor Rob Green didn't respond to an email and called a comment on the impact thousands of visitors could have on virus spread within the community as traffic at local restaurants is likely to increase. Asked if there's a certain threshold county or statewide that would trigger further attendance restrictions, UNI Schmemel responded, quote, I think we just have to wait and see. The one thing I've learned through this process is that things change, and they do change quite often. Do I think it's likely? No. Is it possible? Sure. We've been relying on public health officials to give us guidance in this area from the beginning, and we're going to continue to follow their recommendations, end quote. Keating echoed that sentiment. Quote, when it comes to decisions about risks and what we can do and can't do, we're looking for guidance from the people who live that every day, he said. Right now, the guidance is that we can have fans there and we can do so safely. If that changes, then we'll change our stance, end quote. I'm going to move to the commentary section. Letters to the editor, ads, newsium. But Jewel Cooper, Waterloo, could someone please give me some concrete facts that prove that running negative political ads that disparage the opponent's credibility and morals, or that take a recording of an opponent's voice saying something about out of context of the current criticism is actually informative, educative, and attracts in votes for the candidate making the charges? After a while, they all sound the same. Yes, even when they were aired over and over and over again ad nauseum. After I've done my own fact checking, I really don't feel the need to hear the same commercial ever again. And couldn't something more constructive be done with all that money it takes for political advertising? Next one, A Great Precinct by William T. Ford, Cedar Falls. This is an open letter to all residents in Cedar Falls, Ward 5, Precinct 3, who voted at the Orchard Hill Church this year. For all our health, I did not knock on your door this general election. I want you to know how much I missed that opportunity. I started knocking doors in 1964 and knocked other areas in Southeast Cedar Falls, but this current precinct has been the best. I have always presented the quote, ticket, end quote, from top to bottom, and had some literature for local elective offices. I have always been ready to listen to your ideas and positions. I have offered materials for voter registration and for voting by mail to everyone. At many doors, I heard, quote, well, I'm a Republican, end quote. I always responded that I hoped they were like the best Republicans Iowa's ever had. Our former governor, Bob Ray, was very wise and had a great heart. Today, I would have mentioned Secretary of State Paul Pate for working to help all Iowans cast their votes during this pandemic. In 2022, there will be new precinct lines and I will be 88. So thank you, goodbye, and good government. Our next one, Goodbye to a Hero by Thomas Taylor, Cedar Falls. A hero died Saturday. Lewis Bowick was raised during the Depression, learning to work hard without complaint. He joined the Army to fight in World War II. He was with his buddies, members of the 99th Division, as they held Ellensburg Ridge during the Battle of the Bulge. They had little food, no winter clothes, and for 9 days they did not retreat. Lou came home and married a wonderful lady. They worked together for over 70 years, always ready to help and never receiving a handout. Lou and Bev gave many people a hand up. They built their home themselves, never getting a mortgage, just building when they had some money. The men and women who served during the war are my heroes. Lou was my friend. Thank you for all that you did. Editor's note, a lengthy article with photographs detailing Otto Lewis's Lou Bowick's World War II exploits was featured in the Sunday's Courier Stories of Honor special edition November 8th. His obituary also appeared in Sunday's Courier. Our next one, Honor Our Vets, Curtis Kern. Trier, if you can take a moment out of your day Wednesday, November 11th, please remember the meaning of the day. My grandfather taught me years ago to remember 11-11-11, Armistice Day. I did not know what he was talking about until after his passing. I learned he fought in France in World War I. He said the United States will always prevail, and we have. United we stand. So on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, enjoy your freedom and thank a veteran. Editorial, an unlikely display of unity. This editorial originally appeared in the Times of Northwest Indiana. It's an exchange of unity that many would have thought utterly impossible in a nation bitterly divided over the apparent outcome of the 2020 presidential race. As hundreds of people protested Saturday outside of a government vote counting facility in Phoenix, Arizona, an unlikely pair of women were captured on live video by a major network. One of the women carried a rainbow flag and rainbow clad sign embossed with the words, Make America Gay Again. The other woman was draped in a flag, paying homage to President Donald Trump and wearing one of his signature MAGA red ball caps. Their message was priceless. They had more in common than the political or social differences that they literally wore on their sleeves Saturday in the wake of Joe Biden being declared the apparent president-elect. One stood for gay rights and in vehement support of Biden's ascension to the presidency. The other clearly supported the hundreds of people who rallied for Trump as Arizona's votes were still being counted Saturday. Quote, she's so sweet. We're having such a good time. End quote. The Trump-supporting woman said of her rainbow displaying alter ego. Quote, we're all Americans. I respect her opinion. She's been respecting mine. End quote. The other woman then chimed in. Quote, I think the two-party system has divided people that should be friends. It's not fair. End quote. She added, noting that both agreed on more important things like shared humanity and the exorbitant cost of attending college. It's an overall message that should resonate throughout our nation as election 2020 nears some form of conclusion. Our nation is clearly divided along many political and social lines. Numerous major elections often come close to a near 50-50 split of voters, and the presidential race in many states was no exception. But our nation has always been about healing and moving on, accepting our common heritage courage and patriotism, regardless of political differences. This bitterly fought election, not just by the candidates, but among neighbors, seems to have blurred that tradition of post-election unity. It's time to clear the fog of decisiveness and remember we all have so much more in common than we have differences. The people next door are still your neighbors, regardless of how they voted. Family bonds don't die because of political differences either. Too many American differences have boiled over into civil unrest, violence, and rioting in recent months. It's time to embrace the heritage of a nation that has endured on the strength of opposing factions, being able to shake hands and unify following heated contests. If a young lady in a MAGA hat and another with a gay pride poster can appreciate each other for their common humanity, so can we all. For our political cartoon today, it looks like we have a mountain or something of the sort that has broken into two. If put together, it would read United States of America, but since it is broken out apart, on one side it just says UNI stat AME, and on the other side it says TEDS of RICA. And between the two mountains, let's call it, is Uncle Sam. He has the striped hat on with the stars and the same coat and the striped legs, and his feet are on one side and his hands are on another, so he's extended across two of the mountains laying flat, and the caption says 2020 cliffhanger. Metro briefs. Women's Club meets Thursday, Waterloo. The Waterloo Women's Club meets at noon Thursday at the Snowden House. The speaker will be Maureen White. She will tell of the women's suffrage celebration. All women are invited to attend. Reservations need to be made by calling 319-240-1520. Veterans offered holiday grants by Waverly. The Bremer County Veterans Affairs Office has assisted area veterans and their families around the holidays and plan on doing it for the 8th year in a row. This year, things will be a bit different, such as including veterans who live in a long-term care facilities so they can feel the support they so much deserve. They suggest a dollar amount for each family member in need and have a relatively standard gift bag for those in long-term care facilities. If you are interested in becoming a recipient, donor, or volunteer for this year's festivities, please call us at 352-4209. Yard waste hours change. Waverly. Due to the time change, the City of Waverly's yard waste located at 2800 5th Avenue Northwest will be closing 1 hour early Monday through Friday. Saturday hours will remain the same. The new hours will be 7 to 4:30 p.m. Mondays through Fridays and 8 to 4 p.m. on Saturdays. The yard waste site is scheduled to close November 21st for the season, but we'll stay open as long as the weather permits. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, November 10th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I've been your reader, Aaron. You can access a recording of today's reading online at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.